get, I think what you do is you let.
House Committee on Judiciary come to order. Today is April 30th, 2013. First item on the agenda is I'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 340A.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 340A creates the crime of hindering in the second degree. It makes concealing, harboring, aiding, or warning a person who is wanted for a misdemeanor warrant punishable by a Class A misdemeanor. It creates an emergency effective upon passage, and to violate this would actually be a Class C misdemeanor.
Aaron Belton and Daryl Fuller, please.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Daryl Fuller, on behalf of the Oregon State Sheriff's Association, this bill came at the request of the Tillamook County Sheriff's Office. As you know, when somebody's wanted on a felony and the law enforcement is trying to find them, you could be charged with a hindering prosecution charge if you're actively hiding them or assisting them in from being detained. However, there is no penalty if you're actively assisting somebody who's charged with a misdemeanor. The original bill on the Senate side created a misdemeanor charge for hindering somebody who is charged with any level of misdemeanor. On the Senate side, they amended the bill so it's only an A misdemeanor and the penalty is a C misdemeanor. And the intent of law enforcement isn't to go after a lot of people who are hindering prosecution. What we heard in testimony on the Senate side was that when they are going after somebody who has a misdemeanor charge against them, the very fact that law enforcement can tell the people that they're talking to that if you don't tell me the truth and I find out about it, you could be charged with a C misdemeanor crime, it encourages those people to be more truthful. And what he has found is, in most cases, once they find out that there's a problem with them lying or hiding somebody, that they're much more willing to get cooperation from those people that maybe are in the process of assisting somebody who the law enforcement is trying to find. So this is a relatively narrow bill. And it deals, like I said, simply with A misdemeanors, and we hope that it'll be rarely used but often talked about when they're out looking for somebody. And with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions you have.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Felton.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Aaron Felton. I'm the district attorney for Polk County. I spoke on behalf of this bill over on the Senate side as well, and I have a written statement which you have in your pack, and I left some copies for folks to look at as well. We're here in support of this bill and in support of the law enforcement officer in the field. It is a sensible bill because it does create a complementary law enforcement provision on the misdemeanor side. Something that already exists on the felony side. And just so you note, there are significant A misdemeanors out there which law enforcement officers will definitely be investigating and want to utilize this provision for if it is enacted by the legislature. Off the top of my head, certainly driving under the influence of intoxicants, A misdemeanor. Certainly domestic assaults, A misdemeanors. So there are significant law enforcement provisions and significant criminal provisions which would be encompassed by this bill. It is a sensible step forward, and I urge its adoption. I'm available for any questions.
Mr. Chair, if I might, I would just like to point out that I did submit written testimony through OLIS, so it should be available from you. That testimony is from Deputy Matthew Harris from the Tillamook County Sheriff's Office, who instigated this bill in the beginning.
And I would also note in my written testimony at the very end, I did say passage of SB 340. I missed an A, so obviously my testimony has been seen before.
Okay, thank you. Representative Hicks?
Yes, in regards to assault in fourth degree investigations, prosecutions, domestic violence is commonly a part of that scenario. So will this type of change help hinder or have any bearing on domestic violence investigations or prosecutions?
I think it's certainly, sorry, Mr. Chairman, Representative Hicks, I certainly think it'd be an assistance to any law enforcement officer who is investigating a potential allegation of domestic violence. As the committee is aware, certainly a number of domestic violence incidents are charged as felonies if a child is present or perceives it in any way, but that isn't always the case. Certainly, domestic violence occurs between individuals living together or have some other partnership type of association, so they're not always charged as felonies. They are very often charged as misdemeanors, so I think this could be very conducive and helpful to officers investigating those allegations and also warrants which have been issued by the court in cases of domestic violence assault or assaults in general, if, whether domestic violence related or not.
I have a follow-up. So does that mean that in a domestic violence situation, if the battered spouse refuses to talk with an officer about what happened, or is considered harboring or concealing the batterer, does then that put the battered spouse or partner in jeopardy of being charged with a Class A misdemeanor or Class C misdemeanor? I'm sorry.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Williamson, I think that may fall within the provision of the statute, but I think that's a discretionary decision for the officer on the scene or the deputy on the scene. So it's not a mandatory arrest provision. I don't think that is necessarily the intent of this, to place the battered spouse in the position of being placed under arrest. I think you raise an excellent consideration, but I don't think that is the intent of the statute or the intent of the legislation.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Hey, Aaron, realistically, how many of these Class C misdemeanors do you think you're going to ever prosecute?
I don't think, Mr. Chairman and Representative Olson, I don't think it is a significant number. I cannot think of, in hindering prosecution at the felony level, I can think of it currently only less than a handful that we currently have before us at the current time. I mean, I'm in Polk County right now, so I would say the numbers that we have in Polk County certainly don't compare to a larger jurisdiction such as Multnomah County or even Marion County, which the numbers would be different. But I can think, since I've been in office since January, I may have issued 2 to 3 at the most at the felony level.
Follow-up.
Sure.
So, Darrell, I get the need for this, I really do. But I'm just curious your thoughts on how often do you see, whether it be a city police officer, a trooper, or a deputy, physically arresting somebody for a C misdemeanor on this?
Mr. Chair, Representative Olson, hopefully almost never. Again, the intent of the deputy who brought it forward is when he's out looking for somebody on a felony warrant and he uses the hindering prosecution against friends or neighbors who are trying to be an assistance, he finds almost immediate cooperation. And he started when he was looking for people that had misdemeanor crimes and was getting no cooperation at all and couldn't give them the same speech. He found very little cooperation. So from his perspective, this isn't an opportunity to arrest anybody or charge anybody. This was just simply a way for him to save time when he was out looking for people that had misdemeanor crimes that they were trying to get into the system and couldn't. And he said that little 2 or 3 sentence hindering prosecution speech that he gave just had a miraculous effect on people that he was talking to, and he didn't understand why he wouldn't have that same opportunity on an A misdemeanor crime as he does with felonies. So it would not be, it's not his intent to ever have to use it other than to let them know that that's available to them.
Mr. Chairman, may I follow up with one thought to what Representative Williamson raised about the domestic violence element of it The potential issue there, as I see it, is this would really not be an appropriate use of this proposed legislation. Really, the scenario you've outlined, so what you have there is if you have an offender and a victim there, and the offender is there, what, in my county anyway, you'd have had after the fact of an arrest and arraignment, if that offender is out of jail and they're together, what you have is a violation of the no contact provision, unless that's been waived by the court. So that's a completely different enforcement scenario if that arises before the officer. So if that were brought to me, I wouldn't even be considering this sort of more coercive type of situation given the dynamics of the domestic violence situation. So I'd be consulting with an officer saying, why do you have a violation of the no contact provision there between those two individuals, and what's going on with that dynamic there, rather than this particular type of situation, because it doesn't seem appropriate.
But you could use it. Whether or not you choose to use
there are
it
a lot
is
of
a
things
different
that
question.
There are a lot of things that could be used, but whether that is in the use of the discretion of the officer, as many of these situations, the best use.
Oh no, I understand that, but so. I just wanted to understand that this could be used in that situation.
Yes, that is correct.
Thank you.
Thank you. Any further questions? Thank you, Pam. Mr. Jeffers, please.
Chair Barker, members of the committee. Aaron Jeffers for the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. I'm here to fill in one major hole in this conversation that hasn't been addressed yet, that was addressed on the other side, and also express some of our concerns, which align somewhat with what Representative Williamson was talking about. So first of all, they talked about the intent of the officer in this case and how he went out and he would threaten people with felony charges if they didn't, help them find the person that they were seeking. And he didn't know why he couldn't do that. The sheriff didn't know why he could do it with felonies and couldn't do it with misdemeanors. The reason why is a very long established law and rule that goes back to the common law. Senate Bill 340 represents a major shift in the social contract that Oregon has between its citizens and their government right now. So for all of Oregon's history, and as a state and a territory, hindering prosecution has only applied to felonies. And that's a hole that's not unintentional. When Blackstone wrote his treatise on English common law in 1769, hindering prosecution only applied to felonies. In the 1973 revision of the Oregon Criminal Code, hindering prosecution only applied to felonies, and the law has remained unchanged since then. So also want to be clear that Senate Bill 340 is going to criminalize conduct by people who did not commit the crime that is being investigated or prosecuted when police show up at their door, and they didn't aid in the planning or commission of that crime either. These are mothers, fathers, wives, children of people who answer the door or who don't answer the door when police are looking for someone else. And these people are going to be threatened with arrest and prosecution. Now, currently, if they have an arrest warrant for a person when they go up to their door and probable cause to believe the person is in the house, they don't even need to ask a question. They can go inside and get the person. So they don't need this coercive threat if they have probable cause. What this bill would allow them to do is go up to a house when they don't have probable cause that the person is there and threaten the people living there with a crime if they don't help them find this person. So, we want people to cooperate with police, but the laws of our state and of our nation say that there are limits to the cooperation that the state can compel with threats. We all enjoy the right against self-incrimination, the right to passively resist arrest, and the right to refuse to allow search of our persons or property without a warrant or exceptional circumstances that justify a warrantless search. And under our current social contract in Oregon, the coercive police power, and let's be clear, that's exactly what they're asking for, is the ability to use a coercive threat to get people to cooperate. It's only been tolerated intentionally at the felony level. So we don't think that the need to find misdemeanor offenders without probable cause and an arrest warrant justifies upending the current social contract that we've enjoyed in Oregon. I also want to point out that in addition to the problem of allowing officers to threaten arrest without probable cause that the person is home, it's not limited. We heard testimony originally that this was a limited, narrow bill, but it's not limited. It applies to all A misdemeanors. We also heard testimony about how it would be useful for domestic violence cases, but it's not limited to assault or assaultive behavior. It applies to all A misdemeanors, including the situation Rep. Williamson pointed out. So I hope that that brings some more understanding about the reason the law existed all the way up until now and why we feel like it should continue to be that way going forward.
So, Aaron, can you tell me how many other states have similar statutes dealing with this?
I can't, but I do know there are other states that do have similar statutes that deal with this. I do know some states have chosen to allow misdemeanor prosecutions for some offenses, but I don't have statistics on exactly how many or for what.
Thank you.
And I just say, unless the law's changed in the last decade since I've been gone from there, if you were in my house, if you were a wanted person in my house, and the police had probable cause to believe you there, they can't come into my house after you without a warrant. But you can come into your house. But we had a case, I remember a case in Portland where they thought somebody was in, or somebody thought they saw him go in. They called the house and actually talked to the guy on the phone, knew he was in there, went in and without a warrant to get him, and it was a bad search. But that's kind of off this, what this does anyway. Because it isn't talking about somebody saying he wasn't there or refusing.
Chair Barker, I'd have to check, but I believe that if they have a warrant and probable cause,
no, they, yeah, with a warrant, but they didn't.
Yes,
yeah, without a warrant.
Right, yeah. And that is Chair Barker, members of the committee. I was specifically saying we believe that you should have a warrant and probable cause.
Yeah. Okay.
Mr. Chairman, that was a good question. Mr. Jeffers, at the risk of putting on, I was really, really impressed that you looked up Blackstone's commentaries in the laws of England. I was blown away, and so I looked at. Come on, fess up. You just looked up State v. McCulloch and then Balmer cited it, and you let Balmer do the work, didn't you?
Chair Barker, members of the committee, I have a copy of State v.
McCulloch
right here and would be happy to read word for word Balmer's discussion. There is one other case, too, along that line that I'd like to bring up, which is State v. Turley. And so just to make it clear how this case is prosecuted, in State v. Turley, there was a person who was released from prison and had a condition. Well, he was on probation, so he had certain conditions, one of which was not to be at the residence of another person who he had a relationship with who was also on probation. He didn't show up to his probation meeting. The officers went to that residence, called into the house, heard some noise, heard the woman inside, you know, ask who is it, and then silence after that point. The officers continued to ask inside the house. No one came to the door. Eventually, they decided they could go in and get them. They went in. They arrested the man who was there in the house. They also arrested the woman, and they charged her with hindering prosecution. And this case stood up on appeal where the issue was defendant's argument that she had no legal obligation to open the door or to disclose the other person's presence is at odds with the ordinary meaning of the words harbor and conceal in the hindering prosecution statute. A person's failure to respond to inquiries by law enforcement authorities with the intent to induce them to believe that the fugitive is not present is as much harboring or concealment of that fugitive's presence as an affirmative response made to law enforcement authorities that is untruthful. Given the ordinary meaning of the words used by the legislature in ORS 162-3251, we conclude that it intended that conduct like defendants fall within the scope of the statute. So silence itself, can be a sign that you're concealing. And without knowing, if police call in and there's silence, you know, they could go in to ascertain who's in there, potentially under the basis that they're being silent because they're trying to conceal someone.
Chair, if I may, you know, forgive me, just a brief rumination. I think we have time today, but, you know, the law has to change, right? Crime changes, technologies, criminals employ changes, a lot of things change, and we have to change the criminal code to keep up with that. That's our job. We do that every day in this committee. However, when there's common law that's essentially settled since the time of Blackstone, I'm not saying we can never change it. Again, things change all the time, but it's something that, at least I, for one, I think we should do with humility. That's yeah. Kind of a big deal.
We're not playing. And,
yeah, no, I know. and it's just interesting to me, is this one of those times, or is this, do we let Blackstone rest in peace?
Okay, thank you.
Interesting only to me, perhaps.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Jeffers.
Thank you.
No further questions, I assume. Okay, close the public hearing on Senate Bill 340A and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 186.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 186A allows courts to issue warrant for mobile tracking device to violations of commercial fish, wildlife, outfitters, and guide laws, allows extension in 30-day increments, declares an emergency effective upon passage.
Okay. Jeff Samuels, Tom Wolf, Aaron Knott. Okay. Okay, well, you wait. Okay, that's fine. Please go ahead. You can start either in any order, but please identify yourself for the record.
So good afternoon, Chair Barker and committee members. For the record, my name is Jeff Samuels, and I'm with the Oregon State Police. I'm the director of the Fish and Wildlife Division. I'm here in support of Senate Bill 186A, and I just wanted to just give you a brief about this. You know, really, this is just an amendment of the current statute for mobile tracking device use and authorization that's done through judicial oversight. It's ORS 133.619. And what we're asking for is just that certain crimes, that being fish and wildlife, commercial fish, and outfitter and guide laws, can be added to those statutes that can be a mobile tracking device could be used for. You know, we do have a responsibility to protect fish and wildlife resources and natural resources in Oregon. The Oregon State Police Fish and Wildlife Division does. This would just provide us one additional tool. As you may know, a mobile tracking device is really, there's really two types. There's loggers, where it actually takes, you know, a GPS signal. It goes to a device that's on a vehicle, and it really just tells where that vehicle's been at any particular point in time. And so, and the other part of that is there are some that are almost real time that can provide information about almost where that vehicle might be at, a vehicle or a boat. And so, as you can imagine, our job is to enforce the fish and wildlife laws, commercial fish, outfitter guide that go beyond just on the highways or in cities. We're actually on the ocean. We're patrolling in the forest, and it can be really difficult if we're going to surveil someone or follow someone in those types of situations, because if you're the only vehicle out there following another vehicle, they're going to wonder, what is that other vehicle doing? You know, so this provides us the ability. It makes us more effective. It's an efficiency thing, and I will say that there have been some times, one particular case that we worked on happened to deal with the commercialization of roe from white sturgeon up from the Columbia River. So they were unlawfully harvesting large oversized sturgeon, removing the roe, the eggs. It was transported down to California where it's processed into caviar, and then transported back. We worked with Washington Department of Fish and Wildlife, California Department of Fish and Wildlife, and U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, multiple officers to surveil this product as it went from California back into Oregon and then was sold. And had we had the opportunity to use a mobile tracking device, we could have curtailed the number of officers, and we would have known where the vehicle was going when we didn't have eyes on that vehicle, so that we could identify more sources of where that product was being sold. And so it would really help in the investigation. And in your packet there, I did provide a letter from Washington Department of Fish and Wildlife, their law enforcement. They utilize mobile tracking devices up there. They had a particular case that was on some gooey ducks. And so an individual was harvesting at night in a closed area. The mobile tracking device was allowed the enforcement officers to determine they were in a closed area for a certain period of time, and it was really involved $2 million worth of product that they were able to use that that information from the mobile tracking device to assist them in their investigation. So, anyway, in summary, it would really provide us a very good benefit and efficiency issue for us. It does have judicial oversight because we would have to provide an affidavit to a judge to establish probable cause. The Dash 3 amendment we're good with, the 30-day extensions, 30-day authorization initially of the installation and monitoring of the mobile tracking device, and then if a longer period of time is needed to have that device on a vehicle, then law enforcement could come back to the court upon application for additional 30-day extensions. So thank you very much. You can take any questions if you have any.
Thank you.
Chair Barker, committee members, for the record, my name is Tom Wolf, Chair of the Oregon Council of Trout Unlimited. I'm here to support Senate Bill 186. Trout Unlimited is the largest cold water conservation group in North America. We have 150,000 members nationwide with 3,000 members here in Oregon. Our mission is to protect and restore native wild cold water species. We do that through restoration, advocacy, education. That's why I'm here in the Capitol. That's why we have thousands of members across the nation, hundreds here in Oregon, doing restoration projects to protect the habitat of cold water species. One of the things we can't do that's very important is to stop people who are violating fish and wildlife laws that are taking fish species and wildlife species illegally. And that, in Oregon, rests on the shoulders of the Fish and Wildlife Division of the Oregon State Police. And presently, they have about 125 officers out on the street. That number hasn't varied more than one or two in the last 30 years. Can you imagine 125 officers patrolling 900,000 people in Oregon who hunt and fish and trying to deal with the perpetrators of crimes that illegally take fish and wildlife? It's a daunting job. I don't know how they do it. They are remarkable men and women that do a hard job that is vastly underappreciated by our society. What 186 does is it provides a tool for the fish and wildlife officers to deal with the egregious felonies or misdemeanors or whatever, the crimes that are perpetrated sometimes on fish and wildlife. For example, the case was just mentioned where people were illegally taking white sturgeon and selling the eggs. I don't know if you're aware of this, but the white sturgeon population in the Columbia River is crashing. It is coming to the point that the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife is considering not allowing harvest on them anymore, to allow people who are illegally taking fish to sell the roe. That could have a negative impact on the population. This bill, as I stated before, will give a tool to the police and to the state police, Fish and Wildlife Department, to allow them to deal with this. So we urge you to pass this bill. We think the Dash 3 amendments are great. We think this is a tool that the Fish and Wildlife Division needs, and we urge you to pass this bill. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. This may be a really serious question. Will you be able to use these tracking devices on seals that are taking out the sturgeon?
Representative Barker and Representative Cameron, I don't believe that we were talking about putting mobile tracking devices on sea lions.
Krieger. Captain, this isn't the Natural Resource Committee, so I was waiting for someone to ask a question whether a gooey duck was bigger than a mallard.
Just a little. Any further questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Michael Slauson, Aaron Knott, and Joe Rolder. I'm not sure. Okay, come on up. Roller, okay. There's a conflict.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, my name is Aaron Knott. I'm the legislative director for the Attorney General in the Department of Justice. First of all, thank you, Chair Barker, for allowing myself and Mr. Slauson to appear together, since I'm here largely to introduce him. But before I do, I want to talk just a bit about the history of this bill. When it came in its original edition, this was about, as you've heard, expanding the list of crimes on which a mobile tracking device can be used to include certain fish and wildlife cases. And right at the end of the last chamber, there were some discussions about amending it to require the applicant for the mobile tracking device to return and renew that request every 30 days. And from those discussions came 186A, which caused us to request the dash 3 amendments. The reason for that is, contrary to just a renewal request every 30 days, there are additional requirements in 186A requiring the applicant to make reiterative every 30-day statements about probable cause and a reasonable explanation for the results already obtained and why it's necessary in the future. Now, that's language, we believe, that's been ported from the wiretap statute, the super warrant, which is subject to regulations that you don't see pretty much anywhere else. And this change affects all mobile tracking devices, not just mobile tracking devices in fish and wildlife cases. So a bill that started out as just adding a few more crimes to the list of charges where mobile tracking devices can be used has become something very different and much broader. We have been informed that ODAA now joins us in our support of the Dash 3 amendments and opposes the bill as it currently stands for the same reasons we're articulating, just these downstream consequences in a wide range of cases. To talk a little bit about how the legal standard has shifted, I'd introduce Michael Slosson. He's an Assistant Attorney General in our Criminal Justice Division at the Department of Justice.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, my name is Michael Slosson. I do work in the Criminal Justice Division, and our division does a lot of mobile tracking device warrants and a lot of wiretaps. And Mr. Knotts covered the issues. I just wanted to talk to you guys briefly about the difference between the wiretap law and requirements and what we typically have with warrants. So our wiretap law is tied directly to federal law because it has to be because of the supremacy clause. And part of the wiretap law is very restrictive. So for instance, before law enforcement can obtain a wiretap, they have to exhaust all other investigative steps, all other investigative techniques that might be available, or explain why certain ones wouldn't work. The other thing they have to do is once they've actually obtained the order and they're intercepting communications, they also have to minimize those communications for conduct that's relevant to the criminal conduct. So there's a lot of restrictions directly tied to federal law that are inherent in the wiretap statutes. And Mr. Knott was correct in referring to it as a super warrant. That's the decision that Congress made and imposed on all states. So that language, when you take that from the wiretap law and impose it on a general search warrant law, such as a mobile tracking device statute, doesn't translate very well. The history on the mobile tracking device statute is kind of simple, is that back in 1989, in a case, State versus Campbell, the Oregon Supreme Court said tracking a vehicle, either through the trespass of putting the tracker on the car or monitoring it, is a search that requires a warrant. Well, that posed kind of a problem for law enforcement because you have to leave a copy of the warrant with the person when you're doing a search warrant, and that doesn't make a whole lot of sense when you're trying to do something undercover. So that's generally what this statute was originally created for, is to deal with that procedural problem for law enforcement. What are we going to do with this warrant, you know, when we have to give it over to the person? So otherwise, it's a typical warrant. And so the language you see here is not consistent with what we normally require for warrants. And so what the Dash 3 does, it just takes it back to the 30-day extension or the 30-day time limit with the extensions. And I'd also point out that that's consistent with federal law. It's actually slightly more restrictive for mobile tracking device statutes under federal law. Under federal law, it's 45 days. This is just 30 days. So the Dash 3 is consistent with federal law. As I had, I'm happy to answer any questions about the differences, if there are any.
Mr. Slosson, just because this came up in the Senate side when this bill was originally heard, the issue of serving notice upon the party, correct me if I'm wrong, but that still exists. It just happens after the fact, after the police officer retrieves the mobile tracking device or the warrant itself has lapsed.
Chair Barker, Councilor Schmidt, that's correct. Yes. So what it did was it created a situation which you delayed that service until after the investigation, and it's up to the court how long. I should point out, too, that this 30-day issue with the extension is something that we do in practice. We're used to that. The courts expect it. This is what we have been doing under the language of the Dash 3. That's in practice throughout the state.
Uh,
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name, for the record, is Joe Rollator. I'm here today representing Seafood Oregon and the McKenzie River Guides Association. Seafood Oregon is a coalition of the four commercial fishing ocean commodity commissions. We self-tax ourselves for education, legislation, and marketing. McKenzie River Guides Association is the oldest guide association in Oregon. It was formed by some professional guides 81 years ago. This is way above my pay grade in terms of the nuances of the law. I would just like to say, to point out, like Tom Wolf said, we have essentially the same number of game enforcement officers we had when the Game Commission and the Fish Commission were put together in 1976-77. This fish and wildlife has gotten way more complicated, and there are a whole lot more people. When I was a little boy, a guiding trip on the McKenzie cost $25. It costs 10 times that per client now. So there's a lot more incentive to do things like steal crabs from other people's commercial pots. And so this gives us another tool. It's a remote sensing, which is something I think probably will really help law enforcement officers enforce some of the new things that we've just done in the last few years with marine reserves. And I thank you very much for the chance to testify.
Thank you. Any further questions? Thank you. Fire, please.
Thank you, Chair Barker, members of the committee. Gail Meyer on behalf of the Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. We support the A engrossed version of the bill, and I just want to speak briefly to the differences between the bill and the A3 amendment. Firstly, I want to thank Lieutenant Anderson and other members of the Oregon State Police that reached out to us, I think even during interim before the session started. It's always nice to have people reach out to you and get your input, and that's very much appreciated. We were initially concerned that the mobile tracking device was being extended to misdemeanor crimes, but we've gotten over that now. The issue before the committee right now is subsection 7. Of the engrossed version, whether it should be replaced with the dash A3 amendment. And I would just like to say that this was the subject of a work group. This was convened over on the Senate side. The district attorneys were present. And this is language that's been derived from the Oregon wiretapping statute. And at the time, the conversation in the work group was, that's an appropriate thing to adopt. And the reason is that the courts, both the Oregon Supreme Court as well as the United States Supreme Court, has said this stuff does constitute a search. I mean, when the government is tacking on a device onto your vehicle and tracking where you go for up to 30 days and more, and retrieving data that exists in time, it can be a stream of data that shows where you've gone for every minute, that is a search. And so therefore, it's appropriate to take the criterion that was in the wiretap statute and put it in here. There was consensus in the work group as to that. DOJ is the one that thinks that that's too onerous. And I guess I question that. Firstly, there's nothing in subsection 7 that deals with, first, they have to show all other means of securing the information was obtained. That's not present in here. Or that they have to minimize what information they obtained from the tracking. That's not in here. The only thing that's in here really is that at the time of the initial application for the warrant, a court can't authorize a warrant for any period of time longer than is necessary to achieve the objectives, and in no event longer than 30 days. And the application for the warrant needs to set forth the results attained thus far or a reasonable explanation why it's had no results and that probable cause still exists. We think that's appropriate. When you track someone, tail someone, you can find out if someone goes to a psychiatrist. You can find out where they do their banking. You can find out where they do their place of worship. This is not inconsequential stuff. This is tracking. And we just think that the A engrossed version is the appropriate, strikes the appropriate balance.
Okay, thank you. Any questions? Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
We don't have the paperwork ready to attempt to move this today. I just was thinking back to a past lifetime when one time I was looking for some salmon poachers. I knew who they were, had a very difficult time, and finally just stumbled on their net one night up by Mahoma Falls, and it would have been very helpful if we'd been able to have a tracking device on that guy's car for some time and saved a lot of salmon, I would assume.
Remember, we used to always say, if you're a game officer, can't get the job done, you're going to let them go work traffic.
Yeah, that's right. Close the public hearing on Senate Bill 186. Open the public hearing on Senate Bill 39.
It's dark.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 39 allows trial court to stay execution of sentence while the defendant pursues appeal after considering an array of factors, establishes that factors include the nature of the offense, severity of the sentence imposed, health of defendant, character and strength of evidence, criminal history of the defendant, likelihood the defendant will appear in court and comply with conditions of release, likelihood appellate court will reverse sentence, grants authority to court to set terms of release, requires defendant to appear upon notice from court to do so.
Gail Meyer and Bronson James, please.
Thank you, Chair Barker, members of the committee. Gail Meyer on behalf of the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. I did post some written comments online. I hope you have them. And in any event, I've just handed them in. Essentially, this clarifies authority that a trial court currently has, but the current language is so confusing and poorly written that, quite frankly, practitioners don't know that it is there, and trial courts, when it's pointed out to them, really don't know what it means. So what this bill does is it clarifies a court's authority to issue a stay of execution of a sentence pending appeal. This is very similar to a federal provision. The federal courts do use this on occasions. And the occasion usually is when the trial court, and trial courts are aware of this, they're very aware of when they've made an outcome determinative ruling that may or may not be reversed on appeal. And sometimes you'll have judges actually say it quite candidly, well, I don't know what the Supremes will do with this, but, and they make their ruling. And so this can make the difference between someone going to prison and serving their prison time, or it can make the difference of someone being out and awaiting appellate adjudication before that sentence needs to be imposed or executed. The bill is very clear. It clarifies the factors that a trial court should consider. It allows the trial court to put conditions on release. Again, very similar to the federal system. I would be remiss, I think, if I didn't point out that this bill was first introduced in 2011 by then-Senator, but now Congresswoman Suzanne Bonamici on behalf of a constituent of hers. And it was really it passed through the Senate and came to the House, and it just didn't get through the gauntlet of the very last days of session. And so we're hoping we have a earlier start date, and maybe we can get through the hump this time. Her constituent had the case from hell. Everything could go wrong, did go wrong in a sex abuse allegation. It was a retired school teacher who was substitute teaching at an elementary school, and there were kids in the classroom. They lined up, went out to recess, came back to recess. One of the students in her classroom, who was new to the school, so nobody really knew the student, alleged that the substitute teacher had taken her out of line, brought her down the hallway, leaned her against a door, and rubbed her over the clothing, but in the crotch area, and then brought her back into line and back into the and then they all walked back into the classroom. And two or three days later, when the real teacher came back into the classroom, the allegation was made. This woman denied from the beginning to end, this never happened. She was prosecuted with one count, sex abuse one, and at trial, there was a large dispute as to whether or not the defense could introduce expert witness testimony that this was really hyper unusual. Generally, in all these sex abuse cases, the state uses an expert to talk about grooming behavior and how there's a cultivation of a sense of trust or reliance on behalf of the offender and the secretive conduct and all that. And this was the complete opposite. No secrecy, no grooming, nothing. The trial court refused to admit that expert witness testimony on behalf of the defense. And there was a conviction, 10-2. And then, unfortunately, there was a switch of lawyers and a switch of judges. Long story there, but there was. At the time of sentencing, there was a motion for stay pending appeal. It was denied, not argued very well. New lawyers didn't understand it. And trial court said this is ballot measure 11, got to go to prison. So this woman went to prison for 75 months. It was after she was in prison for a good 2 years that this Court of Appeals reversed her case and said this evidence should have come in. And then on remand, it was discovered that further investigation found that nobody had talked to the other kids in line, nobody else had really done corroborating evidence, and that the witness, the alleged victim, had made an inconsistent statement to the school counselor from what she had testified to at trial. So finally, this was resolved. A no contest plea to a harassment, which is a B misdemeanor, credit for time served. So it's in honor of that constituent of Senator Bonamici that she had sought to clarify this statute. And we do think that it will promote justice in those instances when the trial court knows that they've made a ruling that could be outcome determinative, and it would be appropriate for the Court of Appeals and the appellate branch to resolve it before the sentence must be served. Mr. Brunson James is here. He is an appellate practitioner, and he sees this firsthand in his own caseload, and he would like to speak to that.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Bronson James. I'm an appellate attorney. I practice up in Portland. Formerly, I was the chief of operations for the Office of Public Defense Services, the appellate division of the State Public Defender's Office. I've handled slightly over 500 cases in the Oregon Court of Appeals. And I think really to understand the need for this bill, I need to talk a little bit about the appellate process in criminal cases. I think it's very important to understand what this process is, because appeals and people getting out for release on appeal, they seem to happen rather quickly when you watch The Good Wife. But let me assure you, the real world does not work this way. When a person is convicted in a circuit court, they have a right to an appeal. Now, however, there's a very lengthy timeline that plays out in the state. From the moment of conviction, that person's going to be sentenced and they're going to go into jail or prison. Now, me as an appellate lawyer, I need to file what's called a notice of appeal to even start the process. But I can't do that until that conviction paperwork is entered into the state computer system by the circuit court. That frequently takes 2 months. So the person has already been in prison for 2 months before I can even start by filing a notice of appeal. When I file the notice of appeal, that tells the transcript coordinator, every county employs a transcript coordinator, to prepare the transcript. The transcript coordinator can and regularly does seek extensions of time to prepare the transcript. 4 to 5 months for preparation of a transcript is quite common in my experience. Once the transcript is completed, then the first party can submit a brief to the Court of Appeals. Now, this legislature has set by statute the time period for filing that brief as 49 days. But given the backlog of criminal cases in the Oregon Court of Appeals, there is a gentleman's agreement between the Office of Public Defense Services, the Attorney General's Office, and the Oregon Court of Appeals that the 49-day time period will never be met. The opening brief in a criminal case is filed between 210 to 250 days after the transcript settles. Then the responding party, in this case the Attorney General's Office, is given also 210 to 250 days. Just in briefing at that point then, we're at 500 days. And that doesn't include the months of preparation of the transcript that we've gone through. Also, recently, a few years ago, also due to case pressure, the Court of Appeals reduced the amount of text that you can put in a brief. This has resulted, unfortunately, in a greater need for reply briefs. So we used to have pretty consistently two briefs in criminal cases. Now we're seeing more and more three briefs. So you're going to add a couple of months to the reply brief. Once all the briefs are filed, then you wait for the Court of Appeals to give you an oral argument date. That is dependent entirely on time, and in my experience right now, I would expect a case to get an oral argument date right around 8 months after the briefing was complete. Once the case is orally argued, it is submitted by the to the court for evaluation, and the court will issue an opinion. There's no time limit on how long the court can take, and I have many, many, many cases where the court has taken in excess of 12 months to issue an opinion. After the opinion, and let's say, and I've had many cases, for instance, where the defendant's conviction was completely reversed in the opinion by the court, that doesn't do you anything, because then the state, either one, can petition for reconsideration by the same court, the Court of Appeals, and that can burn 4 to 5 months. Or they can petition for review to the Supreme Court. Petitions to the Supreme Court usually take around 4 months for the court to decide if they're going to take the case. And then if they do take the case, that's going to add about another year minimum. Eventually, you work your way through this process and you get an appellate judgment. What this results in is I regularly tell clients, often at my own financial disadvantage, I tell them that if you come to me wanting to appeal your son, daughter, brother, husband's, wife's sentence, for instance, let's say it's just very clear that you have a very good appeal, this person was sentenced illegally, unconstitutionally, etc. If that sentence is 3 years or less, I'm not even going to take your case because I can't get this. I can't get your appeal processed in time. You will have served your sentence before I can get this through the appellate system. This changes that, and or at least it makes it more clear. I will say that I have asked for release pending appeal in many cases. It is very, very infrequently given. I have had multiple circuit courts in multiple counties tell me they did not believe they had the authority to do it. There was also a period of time when the Attorney General's office, when John Kroger was in charge, was taking the position that release pending appeal was no longer available after a certain time. They've abandoned that position since John Kroger left office, but that created some confusion as well. But I've had multiple circuit courts tell me they did not believe they had the authority to do this. This clarifies that they do. And it's release pending appeal is certainly not appropriate in many cases, but it is in some. And you know, I recently had a trial here a month ago that was 4.5 days of very complex legal motions resulting in a half-day trial. There were clearly very complex legal issues in that case that were outcome determinative that everybody acknowledged might well be reversed on appeal. And this bill just clarifies that it is not mandatory that the defendant bear the cost or the risk of the circuit court's incorrect decision, that there is an option available to the circuit court. It's not mandatory, but at least is an option for alleviating the risk from defendants in those types of situations. And I'm happy to take any questions.
Chair. Mr. Garrett, I have one question, is why it took us so long to pass this bill. We should have done this a long time ago.
Mr.
Chair, saying it's your fault, but I mean, really. Yes. I mean, we know how badly the Court of Appeals has overworked.
Yes.
This is not news.
So. Mr. Chair, Representative Garrett, I agree. It is much needed. You know, my hope is release pending appeal is more common in the federal system. Release pending appeal in Oregon, I took the liberty of surveying about a dozen of who I consider to be sort of the top and most prolific appellate practitioners in criminal law in Oregon. And out of all of us, in all of those years and career, I found exactly 5 instances where somebody got released pending appeal. Out of what I would guess would be in excess of 100 years collective practice experience.
Wow.
This hopefully might change that.
Representative Hicks.
The source of current release authority, is that the last line of the bill, basically, Section 3, Paragraph 2, if a defendant appeals after judgment or conviction in circuit court for any crime other than murder or treason, release shall be discretionary. So when you add that to the prior section, beginning on line 1 of page 3, if the defendant is released after judgment or conviction, et cetera, is that the language that currently exists, and is that it?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hicks, I apologize. I should have brought the most recent brief that I filed in this. The authority is a Frankenstein of various pieces of statute and case law that you all have to sort of stitch together that does permit release pending appeal. It's not just one statute. It's here, there, and everywhere, and it all fits together. But it is complex and not intuitive, and this hopefully would be a little simpler.
If I might, Chair Barker, Representative Hicks, in my written testimony, I cite in the footnote one of the statutes that relates to it. If you keep reading that second sentence, it's very difficult to figure out really, bottom line, what it is.
Any further questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Close the public hearing on Senate Bill 39. Open a work session on Senate Bill 39.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to move Senate Bill 39 to the floor with a due pass.
Representative Krieger moves Senate Bill 39 to the floor with a due pass. Is there any discussion? Are there any objections? Seeing none, so order. Representative Garrett, would you carry that bill for us, please?
Sure. Second, I open my mouth.
Yeah. Well, you seem interested.
No. Qualified.
No further business come before the committee. We're adjourned.